Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guest is Brown University professor and author Mark Dunkelman. Now, remember, we love taking your questions, so write into politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. Now, we're going to get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. You can also text updates about what's next for Politicon and Politics War Room by signing up at politicon.com. Now tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please check out the links to our sponsors, Magic Spoon, Miracle Made, and Fay Nutrition, in our show notes. We thank you for supporting these sponsors. It really helps make this podcast happen. James, the establishment commentariat gave fairly high marks to Trump's State of the Union, declaring he was vigorous in full attack mode, touched all the bases of what he had done in those first 5 or 6 weeks. You know, even said he'd top George Washington as the best first month in the history of every administration. Poor FDR just got left in the dust. I mean, all FDR did in his first month was close the banks, funnel out hundreds of millions of dollars of relief to a depressed country and get us off the gold standard. But that wasn't nearly as big as Trump. You know, but I think whatever the short-term gains, and I'm not sure there will be, I think this is a bad speech and it's not going to wear well. Not surprisingly, it's full of lies. Migration figures are wrong. On claims that military enlistment suddenly started to go up when he was president, Ukraine, on Elon Musk finding $8 billion federal contract. And the problem was, James, it was an $8 million federal contract. Now, maybe to Musk, that's just chump change. And those Social Security numbers were basically just made up. But lies are a way of life for Trump. And I hate to say this, but he rarely pays a price. He learned from Roy Cohn, the big lie works, you know, never admit. But there are bigger problems. He offered no rationale, really, for those high tariffs he's imposed. Now, maybe this is just a bluff. And you know, a couple days or a week or so, he'll remove them from Canada, Mexico, and he'll claim he got some kind of big victory. Well, he won't, but that's what he'll claim. But if they stay on and escalate, it's going to cause real pain, and he'll find other villains. But you know, if inflation creeps up and it goes beyond, far beyond what it was when he took office, I'm sorry, people are not going to be so forgiving. And finally, almost a throwaway line, he said, "We're going to balance the budget. We're going to balance the budget with tax cuts that far exceed the $5 trillion extension of the 2017." He's got all kinds of new ones, and we're not going to touch entitlements or defense, but we're going to balance the budget. Now, at some point, you know, even though he is a great practitioner of the big lie, at some point people will see what a fraud that is, I think.
Well, to some extent, we have to have a role in doing that. And I think the most, by the way, who in the establishment commentariat said
John
that was
Harris.
A good speech? Did somebody?
David Brooks.
Come on, John. You know, and John Harris says, It's insane. So truth doesn't matter anymore. I mean, okay. So I can't allow myself to get ahead of myself. Save the balance, the budget clip, because when they come for the debt extension, when they come to pass the tax cuts, just remind people, of course, he has no intention whatsoever. He has accumulated more debt than any president in history. He hadn't been president but 4 years and 2 months now.
Right.
And he's number one. And number one in all of history. Since from George Washington on, he's number one. Got to be number one at something. So I guess issuing debt is one thing he's number one at. But just save that clip, play the long game.
And the tariffs are going to haunt him because they're either going to be phony, he's going to take them off, and it's going to reveal what a big bluffer he is, or if he's real about it, it's going to cause immeasurable pain, James. It just will. I mean, I don't listen to Democrats on that, or don't listen to Wall Street on that. Listen to Walmart. Listen to Costco. Listen to Target. Those are the people who say prices will surge if they stay on.
Well, first of all, he's going to start issuing exemptions. So this is a great shakedown. What better thing than to come in and say, exempt right. us? All right? Let's see what happens. But we know the way to get exempted from this is through money. And again, there's no person that thinks this is going to work. He's not going to be able to keep him on for very long. I mean, markets have responded horrifically to this, horrifically. And the problem here is we're going to be really tepid growth in the first quarter this year. The Atlanta Fed says negative. Our friend Roger Altman says that's too pessimistic, but even he is not very optimistic. And there's one way to kill inflation, have a recession. Or better yet, a depression. That'll kill inflation quickly. I mean, that'll take care of it really quickly.
He could pull them both off. Okay. He could have stagflation, James.
He could. But the forecasts are very pessimistic. The market is acting extremely pessimistically. Maybe they're wrong. I don't think they are. I think we're in for rough sailing. The tariffs could do nothing but make it rougher, and he's going to sell exemptions, I promise you. That's what this is all about.
James, let's turn to the Democrats. I thought, looking just at Tuesday night, it was the worst and the best of times, to borrow a leaf from Mr. Dickens. On the floor, Congressman Al Green of Texas made a fool of himself and his party by standing up and yelling and having to be evicted. We justifiably ridiculed those crazy Republicans like Joe Wilson and Marjorie Taylor Greene when they rudely yelled at Democratic presidents. So Greene was an embarrassment. And those members not making that kind of noise, but holding up signs about Musk lies or save Medicaid. I mean, it's just sophomoric. So I don't think that was very impressive or very helpful. However, I have seen scores of State of the Union responses. It's a really difficult venue. Almost all are either forgettable or awful. Michigan freshman Senator Alyssa Slotkin gave one of the best I have ever seen or heard. She was measured. She was substantive. She focused on issues that matter to people. She channeled the Democrats' successful 2018 progressive as opposed to left-wing message. Maybe that's because she was elected to the House in 2018. She understands that message. You know, we talk about a deep bench all the time. We usually talk about the governors, and I think that's really where the most important figures are. But she's one of a handful of senators that Chuck Schumer, whose forte is as an inside player, he should have Alyssa Slotkin and a handful of others outside all the time. She is a heavyweight, both substantively and as a communicator. James, I really was impressed.
Exceedingly impressed. And the talent we have, the high-end talent we have, is again, I keep repeating this, is utterly breathtaking. And she showed that. And I hope that they use her, Senator Warnock, Senator Murphy, Senator Gallego. I hope these are the kind of people, Democrats want to believe that everybody is equal or we're inclusive. And so everybody, when it turns to communicating the party's message and the image of the party, some people are just better than other people. Okay. And it doesn't mean that they're better people. It doesn't mean that they're better legislators. It doesn't mean that they're more ethical. It just means they're better communicators. They know how to frame an issue. They know how to draw a contrast. I mean, put the best out there. And it's, you know, and it takes real, and since Schumer and Hakeem have got to say, look, people, these are the people, we want to do. And it's hard to do because everybody wants to be an individual. You're not the boss of me. I have an opinion. Fine. But there's some people that are just way better at doing it than other people, and get the people that are good at it out there. And we got to do that, because in the thing that I believe, and I'm very passionate about this, I think the country is in the greatest peril it's been in since I've been born. That's 80 years ago. And I think that the foolishness of, I don't know, the cane or the auction paddles, I don't think that meets the moment. I think Slotkin met the moment. And I think that we have to treat this as what it is. This is a profound crisis that the United States is in right now. And the Democrats are kind of the only thing, and they don't have a lot of power, standing between us and the abyss. So we have to be clever in the way we do it. We have to be disciplined. And I know that everybody is saying, go out, do something, God damn it. If we're tired of just sitting there. And I saw, actually, somebody said, I got a new idea, pass something. Hey, I don't know how to tell late night hosts this. We can't pass gas. We don't
we
have the
even
votes.
Determine if a bill comes right to the floor, James.
Right. So let's be realistic as to what we have, and let's... We got some things that are coming our way, the debt ceiling budget, the draconian cuts that are coming. And any Democrat, I'll make this right now, the Democratic caucus says anybody that says Doge and doesn't say Elon Musk is Doge has to pay $100. I mean, we have some things to use here, but you have to use them and not other things. And I'm going to be very vocal about being very disciplined, very determined, very much we got to meet the moment. And what we saw last night didn't meet the moment, except for Senator Slotkin, who, surprise, surprise, we got some all goddamn
well,
moral
talent. Well,
I want
to pick up on that, and I've done this before. It's a refrain. But there are, in Congress at least, there are indoor and there are outdoor politicians. Chuck Schumer is a good indoor politician. I think Nancy Pelosi was the greatest speaker and certainly in my lifetime, who knows, maybe ever. I didn't cover Henry Clay. But she's just fair as an outside politician, a communicator, on television, talking about what Trump is doing. But there are others who are so talented, whether it's Danny Goldman or Jamie Raskin on investigative stuff, Brendan Boyle on budget stuff. It used to be Mikey Sherrill on defense. She's running for governor now. But they've got that talent. Use it and understand what you can do. And what Pelosi did inside was far more important than anybody can do outside. And that's where you play to your strength.
Yeah, I think that Speaker Pelosi, later on, I think she was pretty good on TV because she had such gravitas. She had kind of
that
presence,
helps,
you know, in tone. It helps, but it's so important that they identify the people who really do this well and try to put them front and center more and more. It's difficult, and it's going to be hard in the caucus to do that, but it's just, you know, I didn't mean anything, but Senator Murphy is a better communicator than Senator Blumenthal, all right? Senator Warnock is a better communicator than Senator Ossoff. Okay, fine. Senator Gallego is a better communicator than Senator Kelly. Doesn't mean that they're better people or better
senators
or better anything.
Right.
Doesn't mean that. It just means that we want to get the best possible communicators out there because the country is in peril. And we got to use everything at our disposal to try to hang on here till we can have another election. It's just where we are. It's depressing, and it's all get out, but it is what it is.
One closing note, having criticized Al Green, who I think really was just made a fool of his party last night, I read in, I believe, the Bulwark, which I love, that on the other side of the aisle, Ronnie Jackson from Texas was standing up yelling and screaming at Green. Now, Ronnie, you remember, was the White House physician who was nominated, I think, for veterans, and he couldn't get it because, among other things, they found that Ronnie sometimes was a little bit tipsy, had a little bit too much to drink on the job. And that's not something the White House physician should do. I don't know. Maybe the standards are different for a member of the House, but Ronnie, were you feeling good cheer last night when you were yelling and screaming across the aisle?
Well, there's a long history of people being drunk at the state. You know, they just called him the candy man when he was a White House physician because he handed out, you know, drugs like they were candy. I mean, there's so many of these people, you know, the Marjorie Taylor Greene's boyfriend being allowed to shout at Zelensky. We know how just horrific these people are. And the best way to do that is contrast our best with their worst.
I agree. We'll have lots more on all of this ahead.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Hey, James, our guest is Mark Dunkelman, a Brown University fellow, an author, a former Washington policy maven, and the author of the much-acclaimed Why Nothing Work, How Excessive Regulations the Progressives Have Pushed Have Stymied Growth and Progress. Mark, I just want to start off by saying you're at Brown. I hope you're not a regular at the Brown Faculty Lounge, because James has really railed against the Brown Faculty Lounge for the last 2 years. So I hope you're not one of those Brown Faculty Lounge guys.
Listen, good soup is good soup. I don't know what to tell you.
Mark, describe why so much – you describe this in your book, why so much doesn't work, and suggest we're no longer capable of building big things like we used to. Why is that, and what do you do about it?
Well, there was a long period of time where America could build big things. We did lots of big things. We did the Tennessee Valley Authority. We did the highway program. We did NASA. We did huge, big projects because we empowered government, in many cases, to make big decisions. And then we woke up in the 1960s, 1970s, to discover that some of the people making those decisions weren't on the up and up. They weren't doing a good job. They'd made bad decisions. They'd driven highways through urban areas. They'd done slum clearance. They'd poured pesticides on crops so that people were having birth defects. They were a scourge. And so for the last 50 years or so, in this strange way, the party of government, the Democrats, have been trying to put guardrails around government itself. And so we've got this massive pileup of guardrails that make it impossible to build housing in places that need more units, make it impossible to do high-speed rail, even as Europe and Asia are speeding ahead, make it impossible for us to take advantage of all these clean energy innovations that we've got, you know, wind, solar, hydro, like you name it. The problem here isn't that we don't have the technology, it's that we can't get the permits to get the transmission lines from the places that the power is generated to the places where it'll be used. So we could have abundant stuff on all these fronts, and we just can't get there because of stuff that we progressives have done to ourselves.
Well, is the answer the Trump-Musk approach?
No, that obviously not.
Well, tell us why.
That's a disaster. That is taking a sledgehammer to a whole system. And it's going to leave us more broken than it is fixed. There are places, probably, you know, in the Pentagon, where we could use some of Trump and his minions, so that we could have weapon systems come in on time and on budget for the first time in decades. But generally, no. Now, this is sort of an interesting and a nuanced point. Back in the day, when you had these powerful figures, these power brokers, making big decisions about where the highway was going to go and where the transmission lines were going to be strung and how all these things were going to work, we had in this country what was really an establishment. And I use that in quotes, the establishment. That's a term that people used. And it meant that, you know, there's this old phrase in politics, you can't fight City Hall. And the reason that you couldn't fight City Hall wasn't because you couldn't unseat an incumbent mayor. Everyone could. You could. Their mayors came and went. But that there was this notion that there was this powerful group of people sitting behind the mayor who didn't change. And they got to choose which projects were done and where things went and how things went. And they were lawyers and they were businessmen and they were property owners and developers. They were the establishment. And all these rules that we've created since the establishment was sort of exposed for what it is, are designed to force those people to have to run certain gauntlets before they can get the stuff they want done. So if you're going to build the highway or you're going to build the rail line or you're going to build the transmission line, you got to get approvals on the environment, on the endangered species, on how it's going to affect the porpoises and the orchids and all the stuff. And the people that Trump is firing are the people that make sure that we can get past those gauntlets. He's not actually eliminating the gauntlets. It's not making it so that you can do the transmission line faster or build the high-speed rail line faster. He's eliminating the people who are the only ones capable of moving those things even a little bit. The challenge here is to lower the gauntlets themselves and then let these people make the decisions that have to be made and make the trade-offs. Somebody's house is going to have to be moved so that we can build the high-speed rail line. Somebody's neighborhood is going to get cut through if you're going to have a straight line that allows for a high-speed rail. Like, these are hard decisions we have to make. And the problem is, on the whole, government has been told, don't make these decisions expeditiously. And that's because we, on the left, have been afraid that government's going to make the wrong decisions.
Well, Mark, the classic model for this in many ways was Robert Moses in New York well over a half century ago. He was a dominant figure. He transformed the region with highways, superhighways, bridges, tunnels. Any place you go up there, there is a Robert Moses legacy. Critics, Robert Caro and others, say at an unacceptable price that he hurt many lower-income citizens, changed neighborhoods. What's your assessment of what lesson we should take from Robert Moses?
Well, Robert Moses is at one end of a spectrum where you've got one character who can make these decisions at his own discretion, however he likes. He's in control. And that's one model. And it clearly, there's some reassessments of Moses today, but let's accept on face value Robert Caro's indictment, which is that this guy was a power-hungry maniac and that when power corrupts and that he did terrible damage to the city. That's the downsides of all the things that he did. Let's accept that those happened without any upsides. Fair enough. At the other end of the spectrum is a system in which everyone has a veto over anything you do. These are the two ends, and they're both lousy. You don't want to have a system where one guy can make these decisions and nobody can do anything about it. That's from the one with Robert Moses. You don't want to have a system where anybody who's pissed off that their garden is going to be 100 centimeters closer to a street can shut down the thing that's going to help the whole county bypass a big traffic problem. Right? You need to have some balance. So my solution is to give everyone a voice and no one a veto. And it seems to me like that's a doable thing. We've done it in this country before, and we should do it again.
James.
I think your book is very important, and I've been sending it to the potential presidential candidates in 2028, because I do think there's a great frustration. My wife and I I'll ramble a little bit, but we went to Japan last April, and we took when you were a kid and you had rich friends and you go to their house and you just kind of look and say, why can't we have nice things? Okay, why do they have just kind of nice china and silverware? And, I was sitting there and sitting on that bullet train, and why can't we have nice things? What? I mean, we're just raggedy. So to make that overall general point, I don't think we should sell the benefits of building things. All right, we know there's a cost. Sometimes we build them in the wrong places. Some of them can be expensive. But when we talk about climate, we like to tell people, I live in the most climate fragile city in the country, probably. And we don't talk about mitigation. Okay, if I read somebody's climate action plan and mitigation is not in it, you're not serious. I don't give a shit what you say. You don't understand what's going on. And I think when you're selling this, you should talk about the real upsides of it. That's my general point. My favorite example, I'll get you to respond to it, is it took us 4 years longer than we should. We built a new airport. Hurricane, I forgot the name, back in 2017. The eye goes 10 miles west of the New Orleans airport. It opens the next day. The Newark airport, as a result of rainfall from the same storm, closed for 3 days. That's a payoff. If you build shit right, it can work.
I mean, you're absolutely right. The question in my mind in all these cases is, who gets to decide which shit we do, right? Like the problem at the moment is that we've gone from a place where one person could decide to do whatever they wanted to do and no one could say no, to a situation where even when everyone says yes, we can't get it done because it's not done exactly the way that one person wants to get it done. And that's just a sea change. And it's a strange thing because we Democrats, we see ourselves as the party of government. Like that's our self-perception. In fact, if you were to travel to another country and ask about the political situation, not understanding anything, you'd ask which is the party of the left and which is the party of the right. And the party of the left would be the party of government and the party of the right would be the party of free enterprise. That would be the way we understood it. But here we are, Democrats, the party of government, essentially rendering the tool that we want to use to improve people's lives incompetent. We've been doing it for 50 years. It's not for bad intentions. It's from not understanding that there's this inherent tension in our own ideology. This we simultaneously want to build up government power, and we simultaneously, at the same time, we want to push it down to ordinary people. And these two things are in tension. And this is not an issue where one is the right answer and one's the wrong. It's that we need to have some balance of the two. We need some situation, some system that allows you to build things when it's in the public interest and doesn't allow you to do terrible things at the same time. You know, there's this, I don't watch a lot of Drag Race, and some people do. I think it's probably a lot of fun to watch. There's this thing they call in drag racing, which is called warming the tires. Maybe you know about this.
I do. And NASCAR too. You go around and they get them.
Right. But it's where you press the accelerator and the brake at the same time, and you get all this plume of smoke behind you, and the tires warm up, but you don't go anywhere. So what do we do during the Biden administration? That's what we did. We poured more and more money into the system to do more and more stuff without ever releasing the brake, which are all these regulations that have built up all these years. And so, you know, our candidates went around talking about how much money we spent on things, but then at the end of the day, we spent $5 billion or devoted $5 billion to building EV chargers in the places where they wouldn't go so that we could get people to buy electric cars and not be afraid that they're going to get caught without charge in the middle of the boondocks. And there were 3 years later, only 58 had been built. That's not the fault of any person. The Biden administration did everything they could. The federal government, the state government, the local government, no one's got the leverage to get the things built. So that's the thing we got to be focused on. If we're going to spend the money, let's get it out so people can feel the difference.
So a better example might be when an airplane takes off, they put the brakes on and they ram the engine up high and they release the brakes and it gives them more thrust. I don't know what the physics of it is, but holding the brakes is something it's a good. My favorite part of the book and my favorite story and share it with is the story of Amazon in Queens. Okay, that. Just tell us that story because it's really worth people hearing.
Yeah, it's a long story. So let me see if I can do it justice for a podcast.
Right.
Back when Robert Moses was in power, he had the power over urban renewal, which meant that he could take down whole blocks of New York City that he thought were slums. People were living there, but he took the blocks down and they were just rubble, whole blocks, whole neighborhoods. And when Rockefeller became governor, Nelson Rockefeller, he was real frustrated that the buildings that Moses had intended to build there, which would be big glass towers, big, you know, big housing developments, never got built. So he decides he's going to have the state government do it himself. And they're going to build these big, you know, state subsidized housing developments. He appoints a guy named Ed Logue to do it. Ed Logue is just going to build everywhere. And he does. He just starts a gazillion projects all over the state.
Came from Boston.
Logue gets his start in New Haven, goes to Boston, builds Government Center. And then this is the Rockefeller lures him away from Massachusetts after I think he loses a mayor.
He lost to Kevin White. Yes.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And he's going to become the housing czar in New York City, New York State. And what happens is Logue starts spending money beyond what the state can do. So if that's the beginning, that's the leading edge of the fiscal crisis. Everyone remembers New York City. It was a sort of crazy time. It looked like the whole state was going to go bankrupt and worse. And there's a New York Daily News famous headline that says Ford to City drop dead, right? The city's going to go bankrupt and the federal government's not going to help. And so in the wake of this disaster, the state government creates something called the Public Authorities Control Board. It seemed totally reasonable at the time. If the governor's office and the state government was going to be incompetent and spend more than they had and get the state to the point where it might go bankrupt, they were going to have a veto power from the state legislature to fix it. And so they create this Public Authorities Control Board that means that the Speaker of the State Assembly and the President of the State Senate can veto any big capital expenditure, which at the time didn't mean anything because nobody was investing in New York in the 70s or 80s. The place looked like it was going downhill. Get to the 1990s, and Shelley Silver, who was the Assembly Speaker and would die in jail having been convicted of corruption, realizes he's got this power, and he uses this veto, this legislative veto, to kill a whole bunch of things. He'd kill a redo of Penn Station in New York City. Mike Bloomberg was the governor of, was the mayor of New York City. He wanted to do the Olympics there. He wanted to have a stadium on the West Side. And Shelley Silver killed that, which killed the Olympic bid. And then finally, after Shelley Silver's gone, this Public Authorities Control Board still exists. And there's a deal to bring Amazon's second headquarters to Queens. And everyone's excited about it. Mayor de Blasio, Governor Cuomo, who hated each other, did this thing where they sat together at a table to announce that Amazon is going to invest billions and billions of dollars in Queens. Everyone's excited about it. There are going to be new jobs, new developments, all sorts of stuff. And the local state assemblyman realizes that if he doesn't get this thing killed, he'll get primary. So he's able to use this legislative veto from the Public Authorities Control Board to do the whole thing. He vetoes the whole thing, and Amazon packs up, heads down to Washington instead. It's sort of this remarkable moment where you've got almost everyone bought into the notion that we're going to do this big development. It's going to be great for the city. There could be more jobs, more housing, more development. Money's going to pour into the state coffers from taxes. Like, it's just a win-win-win. But there's one person with a completely parochial interest who it's a real political danger. And so he vetoes the thing. And New York loses the whole thing. Now, there are legitimate arguments about whether Amazon in Queens was going to be good. Certainly if you lived in one of the apartment buildings where people lived, where they were going to knock down to put up a tower for Amazon, like, that's a bummer. And if you are living in a subsidized apartment and you're worried that when the neighborhood turns over, that you're not going to be able to find something as good in another part of New York City, that's a bummer. But the question is, who gets to decide what's good for the whole of New York City, for the whole of the Northeast, for all of Queens, for commerce in the United States? Like, who gets to decide? Is it this one person who represents this little district? Or is it the mayor and the governor and people who generally don't agree, but who've come together on this thing? And you see this pattern all over the country. One little objection makes it impossible to do a big thing. It's just not a way to do, not a way to do business. And it answers James's question. Why can't we have nice things? Like that's they've figured out ways to get through that problem in other places in the world. And here, there are just too many veto points in the system.
Al Turner, you have just a comment to get you to respond to it. The progressive size is their own enemy. When I read a story that they didn't like Costco, I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? This is the most democratic company since ever existed. It pays their people $20 an hour. It has the most diverse clientele of the one in New Orleans, is one of the most diverse places in New Orleans. Why do we hate Costco? Okay. And I think it was Amazon that if it's big, it has to be bad. I think that's a rule of modern progressive thought. Size itself can be the enemy.
I think that since the 60s and 70s, when we woke up, progressivism built the big institutions in this country. We built the Tennessee Valley Authority, which connected all these poor farmers. We did rural electrification. We did, everyone gives Eisenhower credit for the highway system. That was FDR's idea. We did Medicare. We did Medicaid. We did Social Security. You name it. We built all these big institutions. We built the military that won the Second World War. We did all these things. And then we saw in the 60s and 70s that power itself corrupted. And that became the narrative, what Walter Lippmann, the great journalist said was the story in our heads, was that power corrupts. And you saw it in Vietnam, and you saw it in the military industrial complex, and you saw it in urban renewal, all these things. And you, to your point, James, you're exactly right. We developed a second narrative in our heads, which was that power itself is bad. So you look at any situation and you tell a progressive who has power and who has less power, and they'll tell you who's good and who's bad without looking at the merits of what it is. That's not the historical. That's progressivism the last 40, 50 years. That's not progressivism at large. And it's not the one and true progressivism. We used to, you look at some of the great heroes of our movement, and they are people that did big things. And so the irony is that we are, you're exactly right, we are our own worst enemy. You had this great piece in the New York Times the other day sort of telling Democrats that, let Trump, be hoisted on his own petard. Sit back, let him try to govern, and let's see what happens. And I think that's fair enough advice. I also think that we should be using that time when he's dominating the news to be thinking about what we did wrong. We need to have like a sort of a come to Jesus moment with ourselves, where we say to ourselves, look, we've got these two ideas in our heads. We've got this idea that we're going to empower government to do big things, and we are afraid of government. Have we balanced these two things in the right way? Because I think that for the most part, if you talk to sort of young progressive activists, they are more fearful of government. They see it more of as a scourge because it's big and powerful than they do as an opportunity. And so we got to get out of our own way. And if we do get out of our own way, if we start showing people that government can produce things, that we can, the government can get out of the way of housing developers who want to make affordable units, that we can get out of the way so that we can build high-speed rail, that we can take advantage of all these clean energy stuff. If it's not just Democrats talking about how much money they're spending, but Democrats actually being at ribbon cuttings of stuff that people want, then I think that we don't drive people into the arms of MAGAism and populism and Trumpism. Like, people are going to a strong man, right, in Trump, that they see that him as a strong man because they think that progressivism isn't delivering for them. And like, that's on us. We got to deliver. We got to have a good product if we're going to actually make a sale.
Albert, very good. Go ahead, Albert.
We'll wrap this up, but let me just ask you this before we go. Your critique certainly applies to many state and local governments. Is it equally true for the federal government?
I mean, of course. You see it everywhere. Every time we've been in power over the last 50 years, our abiding effort has been to somehow protect people who are being hurt by big institutions, including the government. So we've created all sorts of regulations. And what's so interesting to me in the process of writing this book is that you talk to people in energy, or you talk to people in transportation, or you talk to people in housing, or you talk to people in, you know, in whatever field, they all feel as though government is a burden in their, uniquely to their world, right?
Right.
That there's a specific law that affects energy transmission lines, or there's a specific law that applies to whether you can drive a train line through a greenery, you know, whatever it is. And everyone thinks that they've got some special thing. The thing that my book is trying to do is to say, all these are connected. These are all part of the same story. It's the federal level, the local level, the state level, you name it. We're so bought into the narrative that government is going to do abusive things that we have rendered government incompetent, and nobody wants to be for a party that's selling an incompetent product.
Good point. James, you want to wrap this up?
I do. And so if, what Bob would say, Mark, if the progressives think that power is corrupt and power is dangerous, now you got a lack of power. How does that feel? The alternative to power is a lack of power. And good. That really worked well. And I'll just say this. The single most important thing you can do is win the election. Have the argument later, all right? Push society to new bounds in a way that we talk to each other, the way we do things. But if you don't win the election and you don't have power, you got nothing. You just got shit. And that's where we are today. And I think that there's always been, I was stunned when I started doing national campaigns and started meeting the early progressives. They would rather lose, and you know people like this, and Albert knows people like this, they would rather lose and feel good about themselves than have to compromise something and win an election. That's so tawdry. We're so pure. And I think that shit has built up. I've seen it over my career. When somebody come to me and they say, so-and-so is in here from the activist community, I said, don't let that son of a bitch within 100 yards of me. Okay, just go outside and tell him yes and anything she wants or he wants. And I think some of us are to blame for this, to talk about how ethical we are and how bad power is.
I agree with a lot of that. I also think, like, you know, the upside of that, James, is that it means that rather than us sitting here screaming about what Trump's doing, this and that, and trying to fight him on every front and taking every bait that he throws for us, it means that we ought to spend some more time looking at ourselves. Like, to your point, we this is something we can solve for ourselves if we come up with a governing agenda that works. So stop. You know, I understand that it's cathartic to scream about how terrible Trump is. This book is meant to say, let's take a moment, take a breath, look at ourselves, come up with something that appeals to people so that we can win elections and actually govern in a way
that would
give them faith that we can win.
Mark, that's essential, but that evolves. And the thinking ought to begin now, the planning ought to begin now. But the prime focus, I would argue, for Democrats right now is to try to deal with the existential threat that America faces like we haven't faced in my lifetime. And I think ultimately you hope to govern and you need to come up with the sorts of things you're talking about. But I blanch a little bit at these critiques who want to spend most of their time talking about what's wrong with the Democrats, you know, when the country's being stolen from us.
I guess so. I don't know what it gets you to scream endlessly about Trump. Like, we've been trying.
Well,
that
you
for
have
10
to
years,
challenge and him. You have to bring legal suits. You have to expose it. I mean, otherwise you're just Germany, 1934.
To be fair, I think what you're saying, I hope you're involved in the next presidential campaign to talk about this.
I'm not saying that.
I know you're not. I agree.
You don't just say, "Well, let Trump be Trump."
I'm not saying you don't fight where you can. I'm saying we spend our time hysterically talking about the end of democracy all the time, and then we lose. Like, that's a lousy strategy. I'd like us to have a strategy where we're offering people something that they want to buy, democracy doesn't fall apart when democratic government is working well and delivering for people. It falls apart when it feels like the government is not working. It's not delivering. We don't have enough housing. We can't take advantage of clean energy. People are paying more for less.
Well, you have certainly added to this conversation. The book is Absolutely. Why Nothing Works. Mark Dukelman, you've been a great guest. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks. Thank you, man. And why can't we have nice things? Okay.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Now, for the outrage of the week. Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, once intimated that since he didn't have much money, he'd spend the night in his office. Well, ProPublica has reported he found a better deal, a two-bedroom apartment in a luxurious $3.7 million townhouse. It's owned by a Republican donor and run by an evangelical pastor and lobbyist. Now, Johnson didn't reveal this, so we have to thank ProPublica, nor will he tell us what he's paying. But ProPublica reports that sort of arrangement, a luxurious unit like that, could go for as much as $7,000 a month. It's a violation of House rules to take a discount on rent, especially from a lobbyist. So, Speaker Johnson, are you violating House rules? If not, would you please tell us and put out publicly what you're paying in rent for this luxury unit?
Good point. Absolutely. He's only the Speaker of the House. Why should he follow the ethics rules? Of course, we know he's a gigantic liar. And now, you know, he's a rule breaker. This is so typical of who they are. The story I thought was stunning. I'm so glad you brought it up. I'll get to my outrage, but just one thing of praise here, and that's for Harry Connick Jr., who founded a parade in Mardi Gras called Orpheus. It runs on Monday night. It's, most people think it's the most colorful and best floats of any other Mardi Gras cruise, but that's up for debate. But they did something utterly brilliant. For their queen, they had a drag queen. That's the best you can do. When you started talking about that, and you want to mock these people, understand, mockery is the best thing. So the queen of Orpheus was a drag queen. My hat's off to Orpheus. for my outrage, so some the things that happen, they're so like unbelievable, you don't really believe they happen. If you remember in the sitcoms and back in the 50s and 60s, there was always this kind of delayed moment where somebody would like digest what was just said. It took you a second, couple, 3 seconds to digest it. All right. Brooke Rollins, and I'm sorry, that's her name. She's the Secretary of Agriculture. Was asked about high egg prices and that Trump was going to get egg prices down. And, of course, no such thing has happened. In fact, egg prices have gone up. And she said, and I swear I'm not making it up. All right, I want you to sit down. If you hadn't heard this, you might come out of your chair. If you have a weak heart, you might want to just take a deep breath and relax. Her answer was, people need to raise chickens in their backyard. That's right. She actually said that in response to why haven't they done anything about high egg prices, of which, of course, they promised they were going to do from day one. The answer is, raise chickens in your backyard. I think this stuff is so unbelievable, we just can't process it. But the chicken coop ought to be the symbol of the opposition.
Yeah.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Now, for our listener questions, which are great as always, we've got a big California contingent this week, but we start off with Teresa in Monterey, who asked, James, is there any hope that we can put Humpty Dumpty together again when the Trump administration is finished dismantling our government?
Well, first of all, I'm coming to Monterey, I think, in April at the Panetta Institute. So it's one of the great places in the country, man. It's just stunning. That whole part of California is beautiful. I don't know. Okay. I have to be honest. This is such a perilous time that we live in. And, you know, I think we'll be fine, but we just got to try to keep this grand experiment going. And it's under threat every day. So we all have to do our part to get to 2028. That's my general view, but I'm not wildly optimistic about anything right now.
Well, I think that's right, Teresa. The damages are going to be extraordinary, and they're going to take a while to rebuild. It's not going to be if you elect a Democrat in 2029, suddenly you can reverse things. It'll be years. We're going to stay in California and stay in a great place, Santa Monica. John says, how far will Senate Republicans like John Cornyn and Tom Tillis go in accepting Trump's abandonment of Ukraine and embrace of Putin? Well, they will complain vociferously about 3:30 in the morning when no one can hear them because they're afraid of him and they're afraid what he'll do. I think, frankly, one of the very few Republicans who I think will be outspoken on this will be Mitch McConnell. He's not running again, so it's easy. I was kind of stunned after that Oval Office meeting, which the president and Vance was a setup. The whole thing was set up. They brought the cameras in. They brought him in and decided to go after Zelensky. And Lindsey Graham, who was supposedly a big Ukraine supporter, came out and said it was all basically Zelensky's fault. As I say, I don't think of him as Lindsey Graham. I go back to Christopher Buckley's book and think of him every time I see him as Squiggly T. Biscuit. But the amount of courage in the Republican Party today to stand up to Trump can be measured in a teaspoon and have some space left over.
You know, first of all, Lindsey Graham is a joke. It's become a comical figure. I'll give you two that surprised me a little bit. And I think Ukraine is causing some real discomfort in some quarters of the Republican Party. It is. And Roger Wicker, Republican of Mississippi, and James Lankford, who's been on this show, Republican of Oklahoma, both expressed some dissatisfaction. And that takes a lot of guts. I mean, I saw John Thune last night. You know, he looked ill over the tariffs, and he said, "Oh, you know, he was so scared because these farmers in South Dakota are killing him, and they're gonna get killed by this." But there are, as you know, I've been very skeptical about anything in courage in that party, but there are some minor pea shoots here. Let's see how big they grow. But the tariff stuff is causing them great angst. The Ukraine stuff is causing them great internal angst, and they're just hoping it goes away. Probably won't.
Yeah. Howard. And we're going to move to the East Coast in the Berkshires and Massachusetts wants to know, how should we continue to support Democrats, James?
That's a very good question. All right. So start when you see a Democrat do a smart thing. Tell them, call the congressional office, Senate office, and say, I really saw what so-and-so did, and I really agree with that. That's
call
very,
Alyssa
very
Slotkin
critical.
Today.
Yeah, call Elizabeth Slotkin. You say, "Atta girl," okay, as opposed to, don't call Al Green, okay. Call Elizabeth Slotkin. That kind of stuff is important. And promote people who are good communicators. Promote people who can express the values of the party. And you got to have faith in our congressional leadership. I think that they're working hard on a plan to how to be the most effective opposition it can be. When the opposition is effective, let them know you like it. When it's ineffective, let them know you don't like it. You got power, dude. Use it.
Yeah, I completely agree on that. We're going to go to the Midwest now, and Mark in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. What is the job of the CIA in the Trump era? John Ratcliffe is not as bad as some of the other appointments, but he's not in the tradition of great CIA directors. He's a politician, I think, primarily. And I think the agency will resist being used for political purposes, but Trump will demand it. And so I worry. I just worry. I think whatever criticisms, justifiable, many have been of Langley in the past, I think when you start using the CIA for political purposes, it hurts the country. And that's what Trump does.
Yeah. Where's the director of national intelligence in this pecking order, and who could not be any more catastrophic?
Right.
I mean, if on a scale of 1 to 10, Ratcliffe is a 3, the DNI director's a -50. Make that point.
FBI director's right up there with her too.
Go close. Might be ahead. And the deputy director, don't forget.
Oh, the talk show host. Right.
Yeah.
James, there's hope for us, right? Huh?
Yeah, I'm telling you, man.
Can you imagine the Republicans if the Democrats won and they appointed James Carville or Al Hunt to be deputy director of anything? Oh my God! Hey, we have
maybe they'll make us director of technology.
I gotta stop laughing about that one. We're gonna go back to the coast, Redwood City. Matt says is trying to rope a dope, which is the old Muhammad Ali technique. The Republicans just given up while they destroy the country.
Well, I don't think Muhammad Ali gave up. You might ask George Foreman when that fight was over if Muhammad Ali gave up.
Right.
I mean, so it there's this little charge of the Light Brigade. God damn it, here we stand. We can do no other. I want action. I want action now. I understand that impulse. But we need clever, smart action. And we got to pick our fights. And, you know, we fight them in the seas, we fight them on the beaches, we fight them in the hills, we fight them in the valley, we fight them on the plains, we fight them in the cities. You know, that's great, but that's not where we are. We have to, you know, use things that are very effective. I think this chicken coop stuff is really good. We have to pick our spot. Where the public does not trust us. They think we're old, they think we're urban, they think we're out of ideas. And we can use the opposition as a chance to reintroduce or introduce some of our ideas, and more particularly to introduce the American public to the real talent that exists in the modern Democratic Party, which is formidable.
Yeah, I agree. We haven't gone to some of our international listeners as much recently. So we have Tom up in Toronto. My guess is that Tom has no interest in becoming the 51st state. Sorry, Donald. But he says, when push comes to shove, will any Republican Supreme Court justices come down on the side of Democrats? I got to tell you, that scares the living by Jesus out of me. There was a case yesterday about whether they were going to basically put down a judge because he issued a ruling against the Trump administration. It's the sort of thing that the Supreme Court never does. But Sam Alito raised a strenuous objection, and 3, Kavanaugh and Gorsuch and Thomas, went with him. That was an easy one. I don't think there's anything Trump can do that Sam Alito, Neil Gorsuch, and Clarence Thomas and Brett Kavanaugh, who is first and foremost a Republican operative and then a Supreme Court justice, there's nothing that they won't go along with if it's in the interest of the Republican Party. So it all depends on, I think, and I think Roberts does not want to be in the minority very often. So a lot of it depends on Amy Comey Barrett. And I don't have any idea what she's going to do, James.
Just before the show started, they did say that they couldn't freeze $2 billion in foreign aid spending. I didn't get a chance. I just saw the headline. And Roberts and Barrett It was a 5-4 decision.
Yeah, but the four was kind of incredible.
I know. I agree. I can't tell you what a perilous situation we're in. And then, of course, you had Trump thanking John Roberts on a microphone last night, which would have been unheard of when you were covering American politics, that a president would thank the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. But when you don't believe in a Constitution, separation of powers on anything, and I don't know, maybe Roberts felt good. Maybe he felt like I got an attaboy. I don't know.
He was even warmer with Brett Kavanaugh for Just Cause.
Yeah.
James, our last question, we're going to go back to California. Bob in Morro Bay, California, says the total lack of empathy for the less fortunate seems to be a hallmark of Elon, Trump, and the new tech oligarchs. Is this a new world order that promotes directly or indirectly this kind of version, he says, of genocide, but really it's just of total indifference to people who are struggling?
It might be. It's not a question. And understand, things that we would think were untouchable, like veterans' benefits, they don't care. All right? They don't care. For some reason, I don't think they have any ability to see another person's life. And, you know, my favorite statistic is from 1965 to 2025, there's still the same number of government employees. All right? And no Democrat should ever say Doge without saying Elon Musk is Doge. This guy is making himself unpopular. He's something that is a very important tool in our toolbox to put him front and center, I promise you. But you're right. I don't know if they do. I can't tell you that they see other human beings. I think they're immune from human suffering.
Yeah, I'm afraid you're right. Listen, please keep those letters and emails coming in. They are so good. If we get to 7, that means we're rejecting 17, or we don't get to 17, because we can only do 7, because there are many more that are worth doing. So please send them in again next week. We really do appreciate our listeners out there. So thank you, and we'll be back.
Good deal.
Thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Now, following this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, Magic Spoon, Miracle Made, and Faye Nutrition, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them, because when you do, it helps make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And please check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are constantly adding new content, so go take a look. You can also find other shows you might enjoy on the Politicon YouTube channel, or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. Remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.